Well, thank you for inviting me back. It's so good to be here with all of you again. I love coming to this congregation. I'd like to begin today by summoning the spirit of our ancestors. This is an important exercise because we humans tend to have a very short memory. We forget the struggles that came before us and the lessons learned. I invite you this morning to think about your ancestors, whether these are people known or unknown, or whether these memories bring you a sense of comfort or pain. There were lives that were lived, lives lived that preceded you, and without them, you would not be here. Let us call forth the ancestors of the indigenous people who first lived on this land, those whose lives and the lives of their descendants that were forever changed following first contact. And let us call forth the countless souls who have journeyed to this land, those who have come willingly and those who did not, those who saw this land as a beacon of hope and still see it this way, and those who were terrified to learn what will happen to them here. We call forth this energy to help us gain clarity and understand the times in which we live now. Blessed be. Life may be good when the world in which we live meets our needs. But what about those for whom this is not true? The narratives that shape our world, the stories we tell each other, are very powerful and create a lens through which we view life, ourselves, and each other. As we think about these stories, it's important to also think about how we are called to respond when we find injustice in the world. I'm reminded of the words of American author John Shedd. He said, "A ship is safe in the harbor, but that's not what ships are for." I'm reminded of his words whenever I think of our congregations and our role in the world. The narratives you've learned and how you make sense of the world changes as your experience increases, but only if you're willing to let go of what you think you know. There was a study done that found when a person's beliefs are challenged, their brain produces a feeling of distress. When the new information is rejected, however, endorphins are produced. Endorphins are neurochemicals which produce feelings of happiness. It's hard when our worldview is challenged and we are asked to accept another's experience that does not fit within our existing narrative. Letting go of what we think we know does not mean we need to be as a rudderless boat. No, our values and our principles must guide us. In today's world, we're flooded with information. We may not even realize how a certain narrative may be distorting our understanding. By using our values and principles as our guide, we let what we know as being right and what is wrong keep us on course. My father's family, as we mentioned in my introduction, thank you, his family came to this country as a result of the Armenian Genocide in 1915. Both his mother and father were children when they witnessed the murder of their families and everybody they knew. The pogroms that took place, the methodical, well-planned annihilation of 1.5 million Armenians has been well-documented, and numerous first-hand accounts have been told. Yet the Turkish government holds on to their version of events and states that the deaths were simply a tragic outcome of war. The United States supports the Turkish version of these events and has yet to officially recognize the Armenian Genocide. I tell this story because embracing a truth demands accountability. The Turkish government avoids accountability and responsibility for their actions by denying the truth. If the U.S. officially condemned the genocide and acknowledged the Turkish government's role in it, this action would affect access to Turkish land for military purposes. Avoiding accountability often drives the desire to deny the truth. When a painful truth is not acknowledged, it is impossible to find peace and establish a new way of being that honors those who suffered. Compare this to Germany's commitment to teaching the lessons of Nazi Germany. Alan Cowell, in a New York Times article, wrote, "It is a course in a standard German history text that challenges Germany's young to come to terms with the burden of a collective past far more cruel and destructive than teenagers anywhere else in the world are obliged to contemplate." And it is part of an attempt by a post-war generation to explain why the past must not repeat itself to those who will one day run Europe's economic and political powerhouse. The effort, some educators argue, have visibly faltered in the wave of attack on foreigners and the rise of neo-Nazi groups since the Berlin Wall fell in 1989. Yet, in interviews with students both in Bonn and in comparable high schools in what was once East Berlin, a clear impression emerged that while many young Germans sense no personal guilt for past generations' crimes, they do feel a responsibility to thwart any revival of their history's racism, anti-Semitism, militarism, and nationalism. How might the culture in the U.S. change if we offered a truthful account of the genocide and colonization of indigenous people, the cruelty of slavery of African people, the abuses and exploitation of the Chinese, the Mexicans, and countless other stories that are shameful, painful, and difficult for so many to accept? It is a common practice for many of those who were not directly harmed by these particularly dark periods of time in the U.S. history to dismissively suggest that the past is over and should be forgotten. Like the Turkish response to the Armenian genocide, some believe that the events are simply a tragic outcome and no one alive today is responsible or needs to be held accountable. How does denial of abuse and atrocities affect collective memory and behavior? Consider the denial of past atrocities committed in the U.S. How do these continue to manifest in the news stories today? The stories we come to believe are crucial in shaping how we understand our world. We are a faith community that proclaims our values to be meaningless without action. 19th century Unitarian minister Theodore Parker said, "We must hold the Bible in one hand and the newspaper in the other." The practice of our faith, what it means to be a Unitarian Universalist, is meaningless unless it is placed within the context of the times in which we live. We are not meant to remain in the harbor. All the issues that are prioritized by UU Mass Action intersect with one another, and we are called to understand how the driving forces interact with one another. Economic justice is connected to mass incarceration. If people can't meet their basic economic needs, they're forced to pursue opportunities in shadow economies. Mass incarceration is connected to economic justice. People who with a criminal record have very few options for work or even to find a place to live, and in some communities, they're certainly hit much harder than others. The climate crisis is a driving force in migration, and things are only going to get worse. We can see how migrants are being treated in today's world, and it terrifies me to think about what's coming. Racism and white supremacy culture is the thread that runs through all of this. Without acknowledging this and demanding accountability, the world we seek to create will never exist. Before I share the next story, I'd like you to join me in exercise. Sometimes it's good to move. We tend to love to live in our head, but sometimes forget to hold things in our heart. So before I tell you this story, I'd like you to just feel this for a minute. If it helps to close your eyes, do that, and just see what this might feel like in your body. Imagine that your family's survival is being threatened. Perhaps prolonged drought has severely impacted the food supply, and you do not have enough to eat. Our violence is ever present in your community. A loved one may have already been murdered, and the threat of death is ever present. You know that if you stay in your town, if you and those you love remain, you will die. What would you do? Would you leave? If leaving meant traveling to another country for which you don't have documentation, would you still go? What would you do to survive? When my elder son was in high school, he had a friend named Gustavo. Their school was relatively large, with roughly 1,800 students. The student body was diverse, racially, economically, culturally. Many of these students came to this country as small children. They enrolled in elementary school and grew up with all the local children. Gustavo was one of these kids. He was a good student. He dreamed of joining the army. However, his parents, who were undocumented, brought him to this country as a small child. With no documentation and no chance for a green card, joining the military was out and his options were limited. He needed a car to get to work. But however, due to his status, he was unable to get a license. Gustavo was eventually stopped for a minor traffic violation and charged, which brought him to the attention of ICE, which is Immigration and Customs Enforcement. He tried hard to find a way to remain with his family, but after 2 years of fighting, he faced imminent deportation. Gustavo came originally from Brazil, had no family there. All his friends and his family were in this country. Desperate and without hope, Gustavo hung himself near the Marlboro Courthouse. He was 19 years old. This story broke my heart wide open. He died, Gustavo, in 2010, and in 2011, I traveled to the Mexican-Arizona border in order to witness firsthand what's happening there. I did this because proximity is crucial when determining which narrative to believe. On the border, I placed my hand on the wall, which already exists there at $1 million a mile, I'll remind you. The wall that our country has built with taxpayer money. The wall that forces people into the Sonoran Desert. The U.S. government has consciously designed the wall to be easily breached in the desert region, stating the belief that a desert roof to the U.S. would be a deterrent. But when faced with life or death, a slim chance is always preferable to no chance. And many people choose to make this journey. Since 2009, there have been 2,624 documented deaths in the desert. The total number is estimated to be far greater because many of the people who perish on this journey are never found. While in Agua Prieta and Nogales, I met with the compassionate people who serve the migrants in the border towns. One day, I helped serve a meal at La Comedor, which is part of the Kino Border Initiative. It's a cooperative venture between six major religious organizations who often perform with miracles with very meager resources. There I met Martin, a young man who was the same age as my eldest teenage son. He had grown up in a suburb of Detroit. Martin was the eldest child of a very large and very poor family that lived in Veracruz, Mexico. To protect him, his mother sent him to live with her sister when he was about 11 years old. And then one day, he was stopped by the police for a minor violation involving his bicycle. He was turned over to ICE and quickly deported to Mexico. I sat with Martin at La Comedor. He spoke perfect English and had limited Spanish. The police took what little money he had on him when he landed in Mexico. He could stay at a local church and eat at La Comedor for about 2 weeks, but then he had to move on. He had nowhere to go. Martin had no money, no family, no friends, and barely spoke the language. I could not help but cry as he sobbed. And I think of him every day and wonder what happened to him. Some of these stories may seem far removed from you who are here today. Maybe there is someone here amongst you who is facing deportation or struggling with a loved one whose close friend has been detained or deported. Maybe not. But I hope that you can all reject the narrative that criminalizes immigrants and tells a story of scarcity. I hope that you can instead connect with the stories of human beings that are only trying to survive. We are taking action as a faith community to confront what's happening. I felt so proud of being a UU when First Parish Bedford voted to become a sanctuary church, and they now have a guest that they're caring for, a woman who's in sanctuary. I've gathered with many other UUs and faith partners in rooms filled to capacity as we engage in planning how to resist the attacks on local immigrant communities. I'm reminded of our abolitionist ancestors who fought the Fugitive Slave Act. Massachusetts was one of the only states who, during that time, there was no slave that was apprehended and returned to the South. In the greater Boston and Burlington regions and communities such as Framingham, a coalition of interfaith and community networks are resisting the immoral and frequently unlawful practices of ICE agents and their attempt to break up families. Sometimes the coalition is able to intervene. We now have clergy of many faiths visiting people in detention facilities. Through these visits, we have learned the names and stories of people who are so very alone. Our volunteers connect the people we are supporting with attorneys and accompany them to court hearings. If the immigrant has family here, volunteers reach out to them as well. The intervention, support, and witness our volunteer network offers is an important manifestation of resistance. This is emotionally difficult work, but it is crucial in order to counter the narrative being told by ICE officials. Another story I'd like to share comes from First Church Unitarian in Littleton. I was contacted by a worker center in Framingham and informed that the contractor hired by the church to replace their roof had a long history of committing wage theft, and in fact, the workers who repaired the roof were never paid. I was asked to set up a meeting between the workers at Littleton and asked if they could share their story directly. The Littleton church had researched contractors, and they were surprised by this. They thought they found the perfect person. They had no way of knowing his history. The contractor had been subject to a class action suit in the past, but he went bankrupt before he met his obligations. He closed that company, opened another one in New Hampshire, still doing business in Massachusetts, closed that one when too many complaints were against him, and now has opened a third one. He's back in Massachusetts, and he continues to take money for jobs and not pay his workers. This story and Littleton's response demonstrates the importance of understanding the intersectionality of justice issues. The Littleton Church has deeply engaged in anti-racism and anti-oppression education and action over the past few years. There are also a number of people involved with ending mass incarceration. When I approached the people of this church and shared the story of wage theft, they did not reject me by stating, "Oh, we had no way of knowing, so therefore we're not responsible." They didn't tell me, "Well, we're involved with anti-racism and ending mass incarceration. We can't take on wage theft, too." No, I wasn't rejected. Instead, they invited me to bring the workers and a person from the worker center to tell their story and find out what happened directly from the workers. This was a crucial step to understanding the situation. After learning what happened, the team at Littleton reached out to the contractor. Initially, he refused to even speak to the members, but when he likely understood that these folks were serious, he told them a different version of events, which cast himself as the victim. This is a case where being guided by values is important. It's just not right to hire people and then not pay them to do their work. Clearly, if this is done repeatedly, it is evidence of exploitation. My message to UU congregations this year is to tell your stories and listen to the stories of others. Some years back, I was a member of a suburban congregation, and we chose to read the book The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander. Initially, when we chose that book, there was a member of the congregation who said, mass incarceration isn't a problem here. Why are we choosing this book? And then one woman shared her story. Her brother had struggled with addiction for years. He had already been sent to prison twice. And the third time he relapsed, he faced prison again for violating the terms of his parole. He couldn't face another prison term, and he committed suicide. Even though I knew this woman for years, she had never shared that story with us. She stated that she felt ashamed talking about her brother, his struggle with addiction, and his history of incarceration. It was only by finally telling that story that isolation she felt was broken, and we were able to share with others stories that had never been talked about. We need to make space for and understand the stories in our communities in order to ground our justice work in faith. As you listen to what drives your passion, pay attention to how this strand from the greater web of interdependence connects right here to you personally, to your congregation, to your community. It is this grounding that allows us to be present in a way that honors what a person is saying. The grounding centers the story of you and your fellow human beings and gives you context when addressing systemic change. And yes, when a congregation wishes to move beyond solely performing charitable acts and engaging in a justice movement, it means addressing systemic change. We are practicing our faith and taking action to dismantle white supremacy culture when we listen to personal stories by those who are personally and directly affected. And don't try to rewrite somebody's story with your own point of view. When we place a story within context and consider the evidence of impact, not just intent, we truly honor another human being. And it is from here that our justice work begins. Listening requires us to step back and place someone else's experience in a central role. How will we be transformed when we deepen our connections to one another? I encourage you to begin sharing your stories within small circles. And I know this congregation does some of this. Share those small circles and allow those circles to grow bigger than the walls of this congregation. Be the leader and the follower. Act and then take time to reflect on what you've experienced. Share aloud both your sorrows and your hopes on a regular basis. Take time to be grateful when you harvest what you did not sow. And be sure to sow new seeds that will benefit those who follow you. Blessed be. As we enter a brief period of meditation and prayer, I'd like to share these thoughts with you. I invite you to settle into that comfortable position and focus. Begin by focusing on your breath. Breathe in and notice what thoughts come up for you. And then breathe out and let these thoughts pass on by. Breathe in and notice what feelings come up for you. Breathe out and let these feelings pass on by. As you follow your breath, be present in this room and know you are capable of hope. You are courageous. You are able to love fully, if only you allow yourself to be vulnerable, be fearless, and use that love you feel within you to build the bridges that this world needs while tearing down the walls that keep us apart.